This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. With the creation of three branches of government, the founders built a system of checks and balances. No one branch of government is to overpower another. But Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Charlie Savage has documented the power the administration of George W. Bush has amassed for the executive branch, undermining the Constitution's checks and balances. In his reporting for the Boston Globe and now in the book Takeover, The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy, Savage has written about how the administration began and has continued its aggressive expansion of presidential power. Listeners, Charlie Savage is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the program, and I invite you to join our discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Charlie Savage won the 2007 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. He covers national legal affairs for the Boston Globe. Takeover, The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy is winning praise from people across the political spectrum. It is published by Little Brown. You'll find more information about Charlie Savage and the book at the website www.charliesavage.com. You'll find a link to that website as well as a link to the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting our guest did for the Boston Globe on our website, will.illinois.edu. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Charlie Savage, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Sure, my pleasure. Last week, a big story for the New York Times. The Times reporting that, contrary to what the Justice Department had said about torture in 2004, it was abhorrent, the department issued secret opinions on the use of extreme interrogations. This while Congress and the Supreme Court had intervened to limit them. Now, with you, we go back to the first week of January 2006. You had reported that this was possible, perhaps likely, because of a signing statement the president attached to legislation outlawing the torture of detainees. Tell us about that story and what led you to that story.
Sure. Well, you know, torture has been an enormously important and interesting issue since 9/11, and especially since Abu Ghraib in 2004, when some opinions that had been secret in the Justice Department leaked to the media, showing that they, the Bush-Cheney legal team, had come up with a series of sort of contorted legal interpretations of the law, saying that the president had the power as commander-in-chief to authorize harsh interrogation techniques despite a law and a ratified treaty outlawing them, because he had inherent unwritten powers under the Constitution to do whatever he wanted with prisoners in a wartime setting. And in 2005, there was a big fight within the White House and Senator John McCain, the Arizona Republican, over whether the loopholes opened by some of their legal theories were going to be closed. McCain was pushing a law that would make clear that nowhere in the world were United States interrogators allowed to use cruel, inhuman, and degrading tactics. And I was covering that story for the Boston Globe just because I cover 9/11 issues. And I was writing about how Dick Cheney was personally going to the Congress and saying, don't pass this or give the CIA an exception if you do. Bush was threatening to veto it, but in the end, every Republican and every Democrat basically came together and voted for McCain's ban, and Bush invited McCain in, and they shook hands and had the cameras take their pictures, and we thought that this was over. But it turned out that when he signed the bill, at 8 p.m. that night, which was the Friday night before New Year's Eve weekend when no one was paying any attention, Bush had issued something called a signing statement, which is a legal document in which the president instructs the executive branch how it will interpret new laws that he's just signed. And in the signing statement, he reiterated that as commander-in-chief, he had inherent powers to bypass this new law at his own discretion, and so CIA and military interrogators should obey their superiors leading up to him, not this law, when it came to using harsh tactics against prisoners. And so I wrote that story up, and I wrote several other stories about other signing statements that Bush had issued, including on oversight provisions he had agreed to on to reauthorize the Patriot Act. And eventually I discovered that he had used signing statements more than all previous presidents in American history combined. All of the more than 1,100 checks now are on his own power. He's targeted with signing statements, which was sort of an astonishing thing.
Yeah. So how many has he signed now? I mean, how many signing statements has he attached to bills?
He's attached these documents to about 150 bills, but because Congress lumps together many different laws within a single bill by just sort of lumping it together in an omnibus package, he's actually made about 1,100 challenges. And by comparison's sake, all previous presidents in history, from George Washington through Bill Clinton, had challenged about 600 laws. So just in 6 or 7 years, Bush has more than doubled, almost doubled that figure.
And the content of President Bush's signing statements, are they more out there, so to speak, than signing statements made by previous presidents?
President Bush has used signing statements to advance a particularly aggressive, sort of out of the mainstream view of executive power. It's something called the unitary executive theory, which the Supreme Court has rejected as just simply a false interpretation of the Constitution in a 1988 case, and this sort of very sweeping kind of limitless concept of the president's power as commander-in-chief to act beyond the will and indeed even in defiance of the will of Congress and to sort of make his own rules when it comes to protecting national security. And the catch is that even if these legal theories that he's citing in the signing statements are, and also in these secret memos, like the ones you discussed that we just came to light about torture, are theories that most legal scholars, including very conservative legal scholars, but who don't work for the White House, think are nonsense, there's not really a mechanism for repudiating them most of the time, because these things never come before a court, and it's not like a veto in which Congress has an opportunity to override the president's assertion that something's unconstitutional. He simply can tell the executive branch not to enforce a law, and when that law happens to be a restriction on his own power, what that means is he can free himself from the need to obey a law. And this is sort of an extraordinary thing, and yet it's also just one tactic, just one of many, many, many different ways in which the Bush administration has been working very systematically, both within the national security context but beyond it as well, to concentrate more unchecked power in the White House, not just for them, but setting precedents and establishing practices that all future presidents will be able to use in order to unilaterally impose their own policy agendas in the country 5 years from now, 50 years from now. And that second broader trend is what the focus of my book is. Signing statements is just one chapter
right.
of 13 in it.
Yeah. What are those other tactics? Tell us about some of them.
Well, very quickly, we've talked about establishing a right to bypass a law or a ratified treaty at the president's own discretion, especially in the national security context. Expanding dramatically in all kinds of ways the executive branch's ability to keep information secret from Congress, from the courts, from the public about what it's doing with its powers. Centralizing much greater political control over the bureaucracy, the permanent government, inside the White House. We saw that with the Justice Department scandals most dramatically, but it's really all over the government, different ways in which the White House is controlling much more directly and on a much more day-to-day basis what executive agencies are doing, sometimes even in defiance of the statutes that Congress passed to set up those agencies. They put White House lawyers onto the Supreme Court, John Roberts, Sam Alito, and the failed nomination of Harriet Myers, not just conservatives, but conservatives of a very special breed, White House lawyers, presidential lawyers, who had spent years fighting to expand presidential power, Alito and Roberts in the Reagan administration, marinating in disputes over aggressive claims of presidential power from the White House's perspective. In these and many other ways, and we've talked about signing statements as well, the administration has very successfully, very ably carried out an agenda of expanding presidential power that predated 9/11, that was talked about in January of 2001 at the very first meeting of the White House legal team by Alberto Gonzalez as a central agenda that they were going to use their time in office to expand presidential power, to seize opportunities, to make the office stronger when they leave it than it was when they came into office.
Yeah. At the end of the book, you say the importance of these presidents is difficult to overstate. So where are we headed with this?
Well, I argue throughout the book, that, as I just said, I think that this has been the most successfully implemented policy of this administration, even though it's one that they don't talk about very often. You know, they sometimes get hit for being incompetent in the Iraq occupation or the Katrina thing. Here is a place where they were incredibly smart and incredibly strategic in carrying out this agenda. And it's the precedents are there, both court precedents that they won in cases like the fight over Cheney's Energy Task Force papers and courts in blessing the claimed power to hold U.S. citizens without trial as enemy combatants at the executive's discretion alone and so forth. The laws that are on the books now that they convinced Congress to pass, expanding the president's ability to impose martial law, to wiretap without warrants, as we're seeing right now, even the Democratic Congress is passing these laws, and just the sort of political practices as far as centralizing control of the bureaucracy goes in many other respects, these are now sort of part of the system. And we've moved so dramatically just over the last 6 or 7 years in myriad ways, in ways that future presidents are going to be able to use when they want to do something that, under sort of the traditional understanding of what the rules are, they could not do without at least going to Congress first and getting permission. And the critical insight to this and just how successful it has been is that, you know, this administration is also accused of being very partisan. Maybe all presidents are partisan. But in this case, this is a nonpartisan mm-hmm. issue. This is above politics, because the powers that they have established in the executive branch or developed or expanded are going to be available for any president, whoever that president happens to be at any given moment in time, including liberals and Democrats. We've had them as president in the past. We will in the future. Maybe Hillary Clinton will be president 2 years from now. And those future presidents will be able to draw on this arsenal to impose their own agendas unilaterally as well. And so we're heading towards a system essentially in which increasingly the biggest and most important decisions about your country and your life are being made by fewer people in secret with less input from your elected representative in Congress. And if you don't like those decisions, assuming you even know about them, your ability to get recourse in the courts is eroding.
How do conservatives feel about this? This would seem to me to be something that whether you were conservative or liberal, you would think this is pretty radical stuff.
It's a very interesting thing to look at how conservatives react to this. You know, I think you mentioned at the beginning of the presentation that this book has been endorsed across the political spectrum. A number of very prominent conservative intellectuals have, in fact, said, you know, put their names in the book and said this is correct. Among them, the syndicated columnist George Will, Richard Epstein, the very conservative, famous law professor at the University of Chicago, Mickey Edwards, the former Republican congressman and former chairman of the American Conservative Union, and so forth, because it is a central tenet of conservatism, as traditionally understood, to be suspicious of concentrated government power. And conservatives spent most of their time in America being skeptical of magnifying presidential power, magnifying government power generally. They opposed, you know, the New Deal that was legislation in the 30s. They thought that Johnson was out of control in the 60s. But one of the very interesting things that's happened is that during the 1980s, a sort of faction arose within the ranks of the Republican Party that abandoned that traditional conservative suspicion of concentrated government power and wanted to restore presidential power kind of to the level that Richard Nixon had briefly tried to wield before he fell in Watergate and after Vietnam. This was a faction that sort of associated only with Republicans who happened to also be in the executive branch, and they are sometimes called the presidentialists. And so this this idea of that maybe Republicans win presidential elections a little bit more often, or part of it was just, I think, historically contingent that the Reagan administration was in the White House and Democrats controlled Congress, led to the situation in which a generation of conservative lawyers associated with the Mies Justice Department started developing some very sort of radical theories, things called like the unitary executive theory and the idea of using signing statements more often and so forth, things that have sort of come full blossom now in the Bush-Cheney administration.
Yeah. Back in the 1970s, the Nixon administration worked to expand executive authority. Then in the wake of Watergate, there were reforms. And then, as you know, you tell the story in Takeover, about this same time, Dick Cheney, then working for President Ford, began thinking about this, about expanding the power of the presidency. Tell us about that.
Yes, this is this moment of the mid-1970s. The first third of the book, essentially, is a history of executive power and Dick Cheney up until the end of the Clinton administration. It's not just about what's been happening now, but trying to understand what's been happening now. What is the motivating force behind it? And you can't understand what's been happening now without understanding that moment in the mid-1970s, the Ford administration, brief as it was, when Dick Cheney got his first real taste of power. Basically, to explain it, I have to back up just a little bit. The term imperial presidency is from a title of a book by the historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. from 1973. It's a wonderful book. And he describes the growth of presidential power basically from the Truman administration escalating through presidents of both parties to the Nixon administration. During the sort of perpetual crisis of the early Cold War, presidents of both parties began seizing more power in the name of national security, power that should have been with Congress and should have been with the courts. They were saying, this is our power now. You know, paradigmatically, Truman took us to war in Korea without going to Congress for permission, and no president had ever done that before. But he said, I have inherent powers as commander-in-chief to do this at my own decision, and each of his successors picked up on that claim and sort of did different things with it and pushed it a little bit more. But then Nixon kind of pushed the logic of presidential power to the breaking point, and the Watergate scandal, the abuses of that power brought him down. And in the wake of Watergate and Vietnam, Congress woke up, and for the first time in 20 years, it started performing real oversight, especially on intelligence, and it began passing all kinds of laws intended to regulate and control executive power so that it wouldn't be abused in the future. And that very moment was the moment in which Dick Cheney, at the age of 33, 34, was the White House chief of staff to Gerald Ford, the youngest White House chief of staff in history. And he was I went through his files at the Ford Presidential Library to get a taste of this. And he, you can see day after day confronting a Congress that's determined to sort of siphon away some of these inflated powers from the White House to reestablish controls. From inside the White House, that looks like an outrage. They think that they can be trusted with these powers, that these things are going to weaken the commander-in-chief and hence America, that it's going too far, that the executive branch should be able to keep more things secret, but they're powerless to stop it because the politics are against them in the 70s. But from that moment, it deeply colored Dick Cheney's thinking about government and how the separation of power should work, and he would spend the next 30 years trying to roll back those changes to restore the kind of unchecked imperial, as Schlesinger coined it, powers that that Nixon had briefly been able to wield. And he wasn't able, resist Congress in the 70s. As a member of Congress himself in the 80s, he was continuously arguing with his colleagues they ought to be giving the president more flexibility. He was telling them, arguing that President Reagan and his administration did nothing wrong in the Iran-Contra scandal. As Secretary of Defense to George H.W. Bush, he was urging the president to launch the Gulf War without going to Congress, just like Truman did. It's a demonstration that presidents have this power, but he was overruled. Bush did go to the Congress. But as vice president to this administration, he's finally been in the position to sort of realize this vision that he's been cultivating for 30 years. And it was there before 9/11, as I said. It was there from the first day in office. The fight over the energy papers that he wanted to keep secret was the first manifestation of this very systematic push. But then 9/11, of course, provided all kinds of new opportunities to go even further.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Charlie Savage. He is a reporter for the Boston Globe. He won the 2007 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. He covers national legal affairs for the Boston Globe. And he is the author of Takeover, The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, you can call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call now from a listener in Kankakee, line 4. Hi.
The president who kept us out of war and then initiated United States participation in a war to make the world safe for democracy was perhaps prominent among executives on the road to the imperial presidency. He decried congressional government and sought to eliminate it, but is not congressional government the antidote to the imperial presidency? And if so, how can congressional government be reestablished? Thank you.
I think the caller referring to Wilson?
Yes.
Okay. But, you know, there's not enough time in an interview like this to go through everything. You're absolutely right that there have been prior presidents sort of before the so-called imperial presidency era who wielded, especially during wars, more powers than normal. And an even better example than Wilson of that would be Lincoln during the first couple months of the Civil War, when he did all kinds of things that he wasn't authorized to do without going to Congress. Although in that case, Congress was out of session, and as soon as they came back, Lincoln went to them, admitted he had done some illegal things, and asked them to pass a law, retroactively making what he had done legal. And in the same way, Wilson's powers during the First World War, you know, he did all kinds of things, especially on civil liberties, that seemed outrageous to us today, censoring the mail and arresting people for speaking out. But he was specifically authorized to do most of those things by statutes passed by Congress. And so one of the things that we're really talking about here is a different kind of power, not a power that's blessed by Congress, even retroactively, but a power to do things in defiance of laws and treaties without going to Congress for permission. A power, this would say, it's a routine power of the president, unwritten in the Constitution, but inherent to take all, you know, do whatever he thinks is necessary, regardless of the rules, and that's legal because he's the president. As Nixon said, when the president does it, that means it's not illegal. There's that sort of that shift to this idea of an inherent power that's exclusive and is beyond what Congress blesses or needs to bless, even, is something that really doesn't crop up until Truman. Beyond that, the question is sort of how do you, let's say society wants to put the genie back in the bottle, can it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, my final chapter is called The Politics of Presidential Power, and it concludes in part with some discussion of this idea. And I look back through history, and I draw the conclusion that essentially presidential power has generally acted like a one-way ratchet. That is to say, it can be increased much more easily than it can be rolled back again. Even after that backlash period in the 70s, after Nixon and Watergate in Vietnam, you had a few years in which Congress was trying to reassert its role. But as soon as sort of the players changed and the political issues changed, we got into the 80s and it was sort of a different time, that those new controls that they had established started to erode right away. Many of the laws that they had passed and the practices they had tried to rekindle in the 70s were basically melted away in the 80s and the 90s. Things like the War Powers Resolution, which said the presidents have to go to Congress again when they're going to deploy troops into hostilities and have to bring the troops home after 60 days if Congress hasn't explicitly endorsed an operation, for example. Presidents of both parties chipped away at that, and then finally in 1999, Bill Clinton in the Kosovo War let the Air Force keep fighting for 78 days without explicit congressional permission, which was sort of the final demonstration that law was a paper tiger. They let the independent counsel law expire after Iran-Contra and Whitewater. In many, many ways, the reforms died very fast. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting about that is saying, well, even going forward, if we have a backlash, it's maybe unlikely to outlast the precedents that this administration has set. And that's one of the reasons why they've been so successful. And another thing to say about that is, when Dick Cheney has talked about this agenda of his and how he thinks that the reforms of the 70s went too far and were excessive and ought to be rolled back, he described it in the political argument as a way of saying it's almost like he's still living in the 1975-76 moment, when in fact most of those things were gone. And so instead of filling in a valley of executive power, in fact they were building on a mountain. And that's how things have changed so quickly or so dramatically.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another call now. A listener in Urbana, line one. You're on the air with Charlie Savage.
I'm so glad that you're available to take calls, Mr. Savage.
Well, thank you.
I want to say that a very different writer has come to many of the conclusions you have just stated, and I'm wondering if the I would call them machinations of both Vice President Cheney and I guess a man who is his own lawyer, Mr. Addington, are being really absorbed and studied by I guess the whole political community in general in D.C. And I also wonder if you can if you know whether any of the many candidates for president of both major parties are even aware of what I would agree with you is a real crisis in destroying the checks and balances of our system.
Just so I understand fully your question, you referred to some other writer at the beginning. Who were you referring to?
Joel Goldsmith.
Jack Goldsmith.
Jack Goldsmith
was a Republican Bush administration figure who disagreed with many of these theories during his sort of 10 months.
Well, I know, but
I'm
reading his book right now, right. And he's come to some of the same disturbing conclusions.
He's an interesting guy. I know him, and he's a character in my book as well. He's focused solely on this issue of can the president, as commander in chief, bypass laws and treaties. Whereas I look at that, but I also look at centralizing power over the bureaucracy and secrecy and who they're putting on the Supreme Court and so on.
But the bigger
picture is sort of what's happening now.
Yeah.
You know, are people paying attention to this, and are the next presidential candidates in OIT talking about it?
Yeah, I mean, senators either Obama or Clinton
right. So
even
as far as
this?
Are people paying attention to it? You know,
mm-hmm.
I hope that this book is part of at least raising society's awareness of the fact that sort of one layer beneath the headlines, a lot of things that have been reported about and discussed as, you know, isolated controversies actually share a common root, which is this agenda and these legal theories, and that once you understand that, and once you understand that the administration set out very systematically to expand presidential power, a lot of what it's been doing all over the map over the last 6 or 7 years makes a lot more sense. And I just, you know, but... And all too often, we sort of miss the forest for the trees in the journalism community.
Well, I heard you...
Beyond that, as far as 08, very few of the major candidates on either party have talked about what limits, if any, they would respect on their own authority if they are entrusted with the White House. You know, there have been some speeches, especially on the Democratic side, sort of condemning specific policies that the Bush administration has used these powers to achieve. You know, we're not going to torture like they did, which is a policy matter, but is also kind of separate from the legal matter of if there's a law that says you can't torture or you can't do anything else, maybe something else that the Democrat as president might want to do. Do they think that they have the authority as commander-in-chief to bypass that law? That kind of structural issue of how power is divided between Congress and the White House, very few of the candidates have said much about. Maybe Ron Paul, but not the major candidates. Interestingly, in yesterday's Republican debate, there was one moment, you know, one of the reasons they've gotten away with not saying much about it is because debate moderators haven't asked the question.
Uh-huh.
But there was a moment in the debate yesterday where... One of the NBC guys actually got to this issue in one respect. He asked each of them if they thought that the president had the power to start a war with Iran without going to Congress for permission. And other than Ron Paul, they were all sort of hemming and hawing and saying, well, you want to go to Congress if you have time. And, of course, what you want to do as a political matter for getting the country on board is it's separate from what you are legally required to do. They sidestepped that. Sort of, for example, Mitt Romney said, well, you know, that's a question for the lawyers, and then he went off on a discourse about why Iran was dangerous. And so the people who think they might be president are very reluctant to commit to any restrictions on their power. So I think that this is just part of human nature.
Yep.
Even people who don't like the Bush administration very much, if they get into the White House, will be more than happy to draw upon the arsenal of powers that this administration will leave behind for them.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. What about this issue in terms of congressional campaigns? Because you could say Congress has served as a partner in the amassing of power in the executive.
Well, it's sort of a silent partner, I guess you would say.
Okay.
Another thing I spent some time thinking about is how is it that, I mean, the book makes the case, and it's hard to do that in a brief conversation sure. like this, but I hope that people who are interested in it actually, you know, chew through the actual book I invite them to, that things have really moved dramatically in the last 7 years. Not just a little bit, but a lot. And the part of the question is, how is it that something, you know, a 200-year-old system can be altered in such a short amount of time? And part of that answer is a much stronger push from the White House. In the past, previous presidents have pushed the envelope, but only when there was some policy that they wanted to achieve. Like Clinton wanted, you know, to go to war in Kosovo, and so he sort of came up with this way of circumventing the War Powers Resolution. But he wasn't trying to go after that as an end to itself. This administration was very consciously trying to expand presidential power any way it could as an end to itself, much stronger than usual. But at the same time, there were fewer countervailing forces than usual, because Congress basically sat on its hands when this was happening. Why? Well, one reason we have to say is one-party rule. That always sets up a conflict of interest. It doesn't matter if it's Republican or Democrat. The Democrats had one-party rule in the 60s when Johnson was dramatically expanding the Vietnam War on his own, and Congress didn't do anything about it. Now we've had one-party rule in the other direction. Congress goes light on oversight, and they don't criticize the president because that damages their own party's political prospects. And, of course, we also had 9/11 and the sort of perpetual national security crisis atmosphere that followed from the war on terrorism. And whenever you have a sort of a fear of imminent foreign attack, I think both Congress and ordinary people generally tend to be, in this country and any other, more acquiescent when the leader, whoever he or she happens to be at any given moment, says they need more power or sort of acts dramatically, less likely to question. So those two factors meant that we had no countervailing forces at the very moment. We had a much stronger than normal push, and that's how the ball has been moved so far down the field.
I would say here in favor of you, Charlie, in your book, is that it's not hard to chew through unless you're an interviewer. It reads like a novel. The narrative is very strong. So,
yeah, I tried to title it as a story with characters and scenes and sort of plot that develops. So I hope that makes it more readable.
Listeners shouldn't be afraid of a hard political science slog. Let's talk with another listener. Caller, another listener in Urbana, line two. Hi. Caller there? No. Okay. Other folks are invited to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. You mentioned a couple of times January 2001. Back in the opening days of this Bush administration, the agenda and the strategy, were they clearly set out?
Yes. I talked to, on the record, which is rare in Washington, I talked on the record to a former associate White House counsel who was in the first meeting of the White House legal team after inauguration, and he told me that Alberto Gonzalez, in this very first meeting, conveyed to them instructions from the president and the vice president. Well, he's from the president officially. That said, they were to have two mandates as they went about their business over the next 4 to 8 years. One of them had to do with quickly moving to get conservative judges in the nomination pipeline, because this was the first time since 1986 that Republicans had both the Senate and the White House at the same time. And so that makes sense. And the other affirmative mandate was that they were to seek out and seize any opportunity to protect and expand presidential power. And the goal was not just to expand presidential power for themselves until 2005 or 9 when they would leave office, but for all time, to leave the office stronger than it was when they arrived for all future presidents, be they Republicans or Democrats. And so this was a core agenda from the very beginning, long before 9/11, long before anyone was thinking about terrorism. And the various strategies that we've seen play out, which went beyond sort of national security issues, as I talked about, putting White House-friendly lawyers on the Supreme Court, dramatically going after laws like the Freedom of Information Act, the Presidential Records Act, the Federal Advisory Committee Act, and other sort of open government laws that made the executive branch have to do its work in the public eye, erecting a wall of secrecy around the executive branch by gutting those laws, taking actions to impose greater White House control over the executive branch bureaucracy, such as forbidding regulatory agencies from even starting to consider whether to have a new regulation on something like the environment or workplace safety unless a White House officer had approved it ahead of time, so that there's a sort of greater centralized control over what was happening, and nobody knew that they had identified a problem unless an administration official approved it. This and many, many, many other ways were already well into play before 9/11, and 9/11 simply provided both a political atmosphere and a number of new policy problems that needed to be solved that set up opportunities to solve those problems in a way that relied upon very aggressive assertions of a president's power to act beyond the will of Congress and without going to Congress to have the rules changed. And by acting on those theories so that what they were doing to protect the country in the war on terrorism was only legal if their very aggressive theories were true, what they did was they created precedents that said that those theories are true, that future presidents will be able to look back on and cite when those presidents also encounter some restriction on their power that they don't want to obey.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener now. Listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hi. So it's totally frightening, and it's been frightening for many years. If you've been watching it all, you could see it happening. So the big question is, what do we do about it?
Yes, you know, this gets at a question I get asked a lot as I go around talking about this book. At some point, for example, someone always says, well, what about impeachment? Should we impeach the president? Because that would repudiate these precedents, and then they wouldn't be as available historically, and so forth and so on. And, of course, I think we can see as observers of the process that impeachment is not going to happen anyway. The Democrats aren't interested in it, and Nancy Pelosi took it off the table from day one. So it's more just sort of the abstract question. Another abstract question that people raise is, well, what about constitutional amendments? Can we amend the Constitution to say that signing statements are unavailable, or that the president does not, in fact, have an inherent power? He has only those powers specifically granted to him by a statute or the Constitution, et cetera. It's hard for me as a journalist to kind of weigh in on what should happen, or even if anything should happen. I think that it's my role to describe what is happening and what has happened, and how what is happening today is different than what happened before. But then I kind of have to shut up and let you, the reader or the listener in this case, kind of decide what should happen. I can't get out of my lane, given my role. And I know that's frustrating for people, and I apologize.
Well, it's something that everybody ought to be spending a lot of time thinking about. And it won't happen unless the people decide it should happen.
Well, one of the things I do feel comfortable saying is that I really think this ought to be an issue in the 2008 campaign. One of the earlier callers also raised this. I think that regardless of which party it is, I think it ought to be an issue in both primaries, that presidential candidates ought to be asked the question, you know, do you think that you will have the power to bypass laws? Do you think that will you use signing statements the way the Bush administration has? What is your attitude going to be towards executive privilege and where the line is between the public's and Congress's right to know versus your right to receive candid advice? Do you think that you have to go to the Senate if you want to pull out of a major ratified treaty? That's another one we didn't talk about. Mm. In December of 2001, Bush pulled out of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty without going to the Senate, which had ratified that treaty. And this established a precedent that maybe the presidents can do that kind of thing on their own. So that if some future president wants to pull out of the United Nations or pull out of NATO, they can just say we're out and we will be out. This is just one more way in which the administration has laid down a precedent that says a president has claimed he can do something, and then he did do that thing, and because it was not repudiated, it showed that, in fact, presidents can always do that thing.
So the other people you can go to is everybody that's running for Congress or Senate to ask them where they stand on it, and will they fight?
I absolutely agree.
I don't know.
It's also possible that maybe people are okay with these changes, but I think that we ought to at least as a society have an informed public debate about it, and there ought to be a demonstrated mandate from voters, which can only happen if it is an issue before the votes are cast. Back in 2000, the Bush-Cheney campaign did not say anything to voters when they were campaigning for office about their desire to change how executive power worked and to sort of alter the system of separation of powers, even though that was going to be a central agenda from their first day in office. Now, I think in the 2008 campaign, at the very least, it ought to be something that everyone is clear about what their position is before Election Day.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon, Charlie Savage. He's a journalist. He's the author of Takeover, The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy. We have a few minutes left remaining in this portion of the program. If you'd like to talk with Charlie Savage, give us a call, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Let's take another call, a listener on a cell phone, line 4. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
That's me.
That's you.
Yes, thank you. Oh, I just called in. Good. Yeah, my name is Larry. I live in Minnesota, truck driver. Thank you so much for writing the book, sir.
And
thank you, ma'am, for having this guest and excellent open discussion. Very, very healthy. I am 65, spent most of my life on the far left and slowly worked my way back to the middle, and now I'm a pretty strong conservative, which gives me the experience of a lot of discomfort and worry, might say, from both ends, but also some consolation, because that much of the modern American political spectrum, I would say that the elements of excessive centralized power, which is one way to describe the president, and distrust of that power are deep in both parties, both major parties, you know. And really go back to Hamilton and Jefferson, you might say, or the Federalists and the Jeffersonians. And I'm not saying anything very enlightening here, but...
Well, you know, one of the things, since you've been across the political spectrum, maybe this will seem correct to you especially, is I think that, you know, there's Americans as a whole, and then there's the political parties, right? And I think that there's a great deal of hypocrisy when it comes to partisan forces, depending on who has the White House at any given moment. So right now you see Democrats attacking executive power a lot because they don't have the White House and they don't like the president. But back in the 90s, Republicans had Congress and Democrats had the White House. And then when Clinton was doing things like bombing Kosovo without going to Congress for permission, you had figures like Tom DeLay, the Republican of Texas, shouting about the War Powers Resolution and how there's limits on executive power and, you know, the president's acting like a dictator and so forth. And I think that what maybe is incumbent upon society is to take a big step back from those partisan disputes and realize that from time to time, regardless of your political views, regardless of your party affiliation, there's going to be someone in the White House that you don't like, right? For some people, it's George Bush. For other people, it was Bill Clinton, and it might be Hillary Clinton 2 years from now. But whatever it is, from time to time, there's going to be people in the office that you think shouldn't be there. And the founders understood this well. They had a very realistic view of human nature. They knew that human beings are flawed, that it was simply inevitable that from time to time, misguided or incompetent leaders would get into power or responsibility, and they knew that people with power cannot always be trusted to do the right thing on their own. And that's what, you know, they just fought a war to get rid of a king, not because, and if you always had a great person as king, you wouldn't have needed to do that, but from time to time you had bad kings, and then it was really, really bad when you had someone with that much power who really wasn't the best person to be making the decisions about it. And so they designed a system that was not just about elections, but it was about what happens in between elections. It was about using checks and balances to prevent the concentration of government power in any one official's hands. It was about saying the president has to operate within rules, and he doesn't get to decide what those rules are. Congress gets to decide what those rules are. And so this is American-style democracy. When I say the subversion of American democracy, my title, you know, some people don't like the title. I don't know. Maybe I was too aggressive. But what I'm talking about is American-style democracy, because the president is still elected, right, every 4 years, whether that president is subject to the rule of law or not. So that's democratic. But American-style democracy is checks and balances and preventing the concentration of government power, and that is the system which is now very rapidly changing. And the question is just, at the very least, we as a society should recognize what's happening, and we should have an informed debate about it, and that's all I'm saying.
Okay. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. There's so much more here we could talk about. Charlie Savage, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon, for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me on, and I greatly appreciate it.
Charlie Savage is the author of Takeover, The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy. You can find a link to our guest's website, which happens to be www.charliesavage.com, at our website, as well as a link to the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting our guest did for the Boston Globe. Charlie Savage won the 2007 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. His book, Takeover, is published by Little Brown.